You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, former Republican operative, maybe future one, Stuart Stevens. It was all a lie how the Republican Party became Donald Trump. And while the CDC issues a federal four-month eviction deferral over COVID health concerns, Massachusetts primary results, Markey wins, Moss loses, and it very well may be the case that everybody blew it in Kennedy's old seat. Joni Ernst floats the idea that Iowa doctors are getting paid to make up COVID statistics. Senate Republicans fear a loss of the Senate and will bring up an aspiring fig leaf bill to the Senate floor. State polls show a tightening race and a drop in BLM support. The Postal Service Inspector General finds that the mail has, in fact, indeed, been slowed down. And we're number one. So the U.S. won't join the world in helping with vaccine development and distribution because, come on. And the number of unemployed struggling to cover basic costs have doubled in just the few weeks that the extra unemployment payments have expired. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, everybody. Thank you for joining us. It is Wednesday, hump day, as we used to call it back in the day, because you were in the middle of the week. I don't know. Time just sort of feels like it's just floating around, we're just stuck in this weird world of coronavirus. There were some interesting statistics out of Indiana. Indiana schools, they have like a 9% positive rate. Kids have been back in school now for a couple of weeks. Numbers still not too bad coming out of the schools. Broadly speaking, numbers have not gone up in the state. Very hard to figure out what the deal is. We mentioned yesterday that New York City will be reopening a week or two later than originally had planned. Bill de Blasio doing his best to sort of make everybody frustrated one way or another. There's no reason they couldn't have done this 3 or 4 weeks ago and helped everybody in the process. But looking forward seems to be problematic for some folks. And of course, it is hindered by the fact that we have no national response. It's a complete disaster on that level. But let's turn to some mixed news. In the Massachusetts primary, there are three really, I want to say primary races, but there, I think it was more, but there were three key races here. One was Ed Markey being challenged by Joe Kennedy. Joe Kennedy, a sitting congressman in the 4th District of Massachusetts. Some people contend that there's just a branding difference between the two of them. I don't think that's quite the case. Nevertheless, Markey has been very aggressive with climate change, particularly the Green New Deal, other initiatives. What was also rather stunning about this, and I'm in favor of primaries. I mean, just broadly speaking, generically, I think there should always be primaries. Good. what was interesting was to watch the Democratic leadership, who you will recall, maintain that there is a blacklist against any political firm that would help challengers of incumbents. Now, I guess maybe technically the Democratic leadership was saying this in the House just about House challenges, not Senate challenges. But nevertheless, it makes it very hard to take them seriously that there is some type of, I don't know, principle in operation here other than an ideological one. Joe Kennedy lost. He did win Worcester. I don't know how that happened, but he lost the rest of the state. Alex Morris lost pretty handily to Richie Neal in Massachusetts' first district. This was, again, another Justice Democrat attempt to challenge a one of the highest-ranking members of the Democratic leadership, the chairman of the House and Ways and Means Committee, and a guy who really behind the scenes has a decent voting record, but behind the scenes sabotaged much of the progressive agenda in terms of like drug pricing, in terms of like the attempt to get Trump's tax returns. I mentioned this quite a bit yesterday. Medicare for All fighting against. Remember, they had that hearing and they weren't allowed to use the words Medicare for All. That was Richie Neal who pushed that. But it was not enough. Local voters in Massachusetts, their concerns aren't maybe as national. And then in the fourth district, filling in for Kennedy's seat, it looks like Jake Auchincloss, and we don't know yet, a former Republican is going to win that seat. There were multiple progressives running in that. The closest one was Jesse Mermel. And unfortunately, we don't know, you know, it appears that the progressives split the vote. So, you know, down the road, progressives got to get a little smarter. At one point, look at the polls. It happened with Mondaire Jones and he won in New York. At one point, you got to look at the polls and say, where is the biggest opportunity for progressives? Even if it's not the progressive we want. Or not. And we now have a former Republican who's going to end up being, if he pulls it out, which it looks like he's going to, is going to be the one of the most conservative members of the entire Democratic caucus. We may not need his vote. There may be another crack at him next time, but we shall see. Here is Ed Markey. Like we say, won fairly well, easily, in Massachusetts, beating Joe Kennedy, the first Kennedy who's lost in Massachusetts, maybe ever. Here is Ed Markey.
In this race, justice was on the ballot. Healthcare justice. That's Medicare for All and universal health care. Educational justice, so that every student has access to first-class schools and well-paid teachers. Economic justice, so that 3 billionaires don't hold more wealth than the bottom 50 percentile of our population combined. That's an economic system that's gone off the rails. Racial justice, so that we confront our history, make reparations, and root out the systemic racism that keeps us from achieving the promise of liberty and justice for everyone. Today and every day, we say Black Lives Matter, Black Voices Matter. And environmental justice. That's the Green New Deal.
Liberty. Liberty. So there's Ed Markey. Here's an example from the debate on one of the reasons why I think Joe Kennedy lost. I don't know how much of it was ideological. I mean, to a certain extent, there is a in some quarters, it is impossible for a Kennedy to lose in Massachusetts. Here, though, I think it's why Kennedy couldn't win. One, in part, because Markey is a good senator. Here is Joe Kennedy. You know, this is where you would expect the Kennedy to shine a little bit, frankly. But go ahead.
Congressman, what's your worst personality trait, or what does your wife think is your worst trait?
Those are going to be two very different things. look, I think this is more information than you need. My wife does not like it when I does not like being anywhere near my feet. So feet on the couch is like the big thing that drives her nuts.
How about you, Senator Markey? What's your wife think is your worst habit, or what do you think is your worst trait?
My wife cannot believe how obsessed I am with the Red Sox, the Patriots, the Bruins, and the Celtics. She thinks it's a pathology. I tell her that we're genetically hardwired in Massachusetts. You're born a Democrat and a Red Sox fan. Then you're baptized 7 days later.
That is low, what we call in Massachusetts, low-hanging fruit. Very low-hanging fruit. I love the Red Sox too much. What's my biggest weakness? My biggest weakness is probably that I work too hard. That's what it would be. You know, like it's one of those deals. That is a the classic interview technique, and one would imagine he would have had that ready. But there you go.
Feet are not a personality trait.
I think Kennedy was trying to be too clever by half, going indeed for the foot fetish vote in Massachusetts.
I don't know what was going on there, to be honest with you. But I put my feet on the couch. What? Folks, one of today's sponsors is BetterHelp, who's given our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Lots of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. It can take months, weeks before they see you. When you sign up with BetterHelp, what they do is they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, fill out a little bit of a survey, not very long. You'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. Look, obviously, a lot of people not feeling comfortable going inside to talk to a therapist in this instance, you know, during coronavirus. Also, a tremendous amount of stress during this period. Not only is it stressful because of the added stresses of like, what are we going to do with the kids if you have kids? Or this sucks, I can't go out and party on a regular basis without feeling like I'm risking, you know, my parents' lives or whatever it is. Bottom line, this is a great way to find a therapist. If you've never been to a therapist, this is a great way to start. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason, no additional charge whatsoever. They have thousands of licensed therapists. They're all over the country. They have therapists with specialties that may not be available in your area or might be hard for you to find. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp. And they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month. When you go to betterhelp.com/majority report, that's betterhelp, HELP.com/majority report. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to have Stuart Stevens on Zoom, I believe it's going to be, talking about his book, It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. Right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the Zoom, I believe. Do we have him?
Hey, guys.
We do. Stuart Stevens, author of It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. Stuart, welcome to the program.
Well, great to be here, man.
I should also say you're a, I don't know, former Republican strategist. Do you consider yourself a former Republican strategist or a
I consider myself former.
Former?
Okay. I turned in my union card.
You turned in your what? Is there really a union for Republican? I didn't think so. So, all right, let's start with this. Because I got to tell you, like, you know, I think you probably had a lot of interviews where people have been a little bit skeptical about, you know, the Never Trumpers and to a certain extent, the Lincoln Project. So why did you write the book?
Great question. It goes back to 2016. You know, a lot of people were wrong about Donald Trump, but it's really hard to find somebody who was more wrong than me. I didn't think he'd win the primary. I didn't think he'd win the general. And in retrospect, it was because I didn't want to admit to myself what that meant about the Republican Party. And then I went through a period after he won, kind of like a lot of my friends, saying, well, you know, this isn't really the Republican Party. He hijacked it. But I really don't know how to sustain that. I mean, he's head of the Republican Party. Republican Party is the party that endorsed Roy Moore and attacked John Bolton. So I started asking myself, how did this happen? And it really began in that pursuit. I mean, I kind of believe what our high school English teachers taught us, that if you can't write it, you don't understand it. So it really began as a very personal pursuit. I didn't intend to write it as a book at first, but then I ended up writing a book. It really to help me try to understand it.
What was, in the course of writing the book, what was like the main, what was the primary realization that you came upon, and what were the sort of, I guess, the emotional, intellectual building blocks that made you come to that conclusion?
Well, I was fascinated by the whole history of this tension in the Republican Party that dates from World War II. I mean, it really goes back to the Eisenhower wing, which is kind of a sane, governing, boring wing, and the Joe McCarthy wing, which was insane. You know, if Fox News had been around, Joe McCarthy was there, he would have been their darling. He would have had his own show. And how that played out. And I always thought that our side of the party, call it, you know, that side that was a governing side, that was a sane side, was the dominant gene. I worked in a lot of campaigns. I went down to Austin in April of 99 to work for George Bush. And, you know, at that time, you could look at conservatism and say a lot of it was sort of a victim of its own success. Cold War was over. I guess we'd won. Welfare was a big issue with conservatives, and Bill Clinton instituted welfare reform. There was a whole crime was going down. Taxes were certainly down from 70% that they once were. So I think Governor Bush and others looked at sort of what is a new construct of conservatism. And that out of that came compassionate conservatism, that idea. And, you know, if you remember at the time, Bush got a lot of criticism from a lot of conservatives saying, are you saying by calling it compassionate conservatism that conservatism hasn't been compassionate? And Bush's answer to that pretty much was, yeah, that's what I'm saying. And for him, the access to that was education. If you look at No Child Left Behind, you know, signed with Ted Kennedy over his right shoulder. But then that's probably died on 9/11 when he became a wartime president.
So wait, so I want to circle back to that, because I'm curious as to why. I mean, I'm not sure I buy the premise, frankly, but if I did, I'm not sure I understand why on 9/11. But I get you're saying that there may not have been issues necessarily for them to run on after the Bill Clinton had basically triangulated and taken a lot of space up, particularly of moderate Republicans. Many people refer to Bill Clinton as the best Republican president we've had in some respects. But clearly, the things that you're talking about in this book pre-existed that era, right? No, I mean, no, I get your metaphor about the dominant gene, but what doesn't happen in the context of passing on genes is that one gene leverages another gene knowingly, right? Because you, I mean, I think in the book you allude to at least some awareness that that dominant, what whichever one was dominant or submissive, the relationship between them was not like genes. The relationship was like leverage and a tool.
Look, I think the Republican Party had a dark side and a side that was very optimistic and aspirational. I don't think it was ever perfect. I never thought that. But if you really think about what were sort of the basic principles that most people in the dark ages, say 4 years ago, would have agreed the Republican Party stood for, it would have been character counts, personal responsibility, free trade, pro-legal immigration. I mean, Ronald Reagan announced in front of the Statue of Liberty, signed a bill that made everybody in the country before 1983 legal, strong on Russia. And now the party's not just drift away from those things, it's actively against those things. So, you know, when I wrote this book, there's a sort of trope of books about Washington, if only they had listened to me. Like John Bolton just wrote one of those. Right. I didn't want to write that book because they did listen to me. And I think if one of the reasons I was really drawn to the Republican Party is this concept of personal responsibility, it seems important to take personal responsibility as moving forward and trying to analyze it. So that's why in the beginning of this book, I say, blame me. I mean, I was part of this.
Oh, I'm okay to blame you. But I'm just curious.
Work that out.
Well, I mean, you share the blame with a lot of people as far as I'm concerned, but let's talk about some of those principles. I'm just curious about even those, because what does personal responsibility mean? Like, I mean, obviously you're saying blame me. Okay, fair enough. But what is that as a political concept?
What it meant was let's take Donald Trump for the example, right? Nothing that happens in Donald Trump's life is his fault. And he will take responsibility for nothing. So the opposite of that is a concept of personal responsibility. That if I go out and I commit a crime, that is an individual decision. It is not a societal decision. It is I have free will here, that this is a choice that I make, and that there is a good and there is an evil. And there are societal elements in it, but ultimately that choice is mine. So it really is sort of like an empowerment of the individual. If you are a person who treats others badly, if you're mean, if you're cruel, that there are always reasons for that. You can justify it, but ultimately that responsibility is on you. And now I think that breaks down in a governing sense. You have to be very careful about that because there are large societal efforts here. And I think where conservatives went wrong, and I write about this, was looking at sort of systematic poverty and trying to say if only individuals worked harder or something, they have the ability to lift themselves out of poverty, which I think is really where that breaks down.
Where does it work? Because Donald Trump wasn't around when these principles that you're talking about were operative, right? And when they were deployed against, I guess, I don't know, liberals or Democrats or whatever it was the opposition was called at that time. And so I don't understand, like, if it doesn't apply to poverty, and you mentioned education with George Bush, I'm not a fan of that, despite the fact that Ted Kennedy sent. I thought that whole, and I didn't like the follow up with Obama either. But I'll stipulate that it was in reaction to feeling that education is important, and we don't want to, you know, soft bigotry, et cetera, et cetera. But where does, like, because it, to me, the whole personal responsibility thing also sounds like a lie. Like, where does that get deployed? I mean, yes, if you commit a crime, you gotta do the time. But this whole thing of like personal responsibility was deployed when Paul Ryan, I know you were a campaign manager for Mitt Romney, you know, made up a story about brown bagging lunches and that kids shouldn't get free lunches because they feel better about having a brown bag lunch. Well, that's not, that's, I mean, that's fine, but that's nonsense. That's not the issue here. The issue is that the kids don't have the opportunity to eat. But personal responsibility comes into all this. Like, where, when was it not a lie?
Oh, listen, I think that there was a, if you go back, say, just focus on the issue of crime, right? There was a sort of philosophy that individuals really should not be held accountable, that there were larger societal forces at work that took away this concept of free will for them to commit crime. And I think that's wrong. And I think that if you go to Bill Clinton, I mean, Bill Clinton really ran as sort of a reformist on that. I mean, he was the one, you know, when he ran as a different kind of Democrat, that he was saying that we should hold people responsible. He's the one who hired 100,000 new cops on the street. I mean, in many ways, sort of fascinating that the 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign was running against the 1992 Bill Clinton campaign, which I actually look as a very positive sign for the Democratic Party, because I think parties need to change like that and grow. So look, I think that these character counts. So if you go back and you read the stuff that William Bennett wrote about Bill Clinton in the late 90s and the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, he wrote this beautiful stuff about how character is the soul of the nation and how the president is more important than one set of issues and another set of issues. We really need to hold that. Well, I believed all that, you know. I mean, I worked for Bob Dole. I don't see why it doesn't apply to Donald Trump. I it just boggles my mind that you could believe that then and not believe it now.
Oh, so, you're talking about in terms of Republicans. Well, I mean, to be fair, Bennett, meanwhile, was also had a massive gambling problem and was using it to pay off dominatrix, which, you know, I'm not kink shaming anybody, but I'm just saying that, like, he's not in a position to be talking about, you know, sexual picadilla. I mean, he was lying. He was lying, too. He didn't believe any of that in the first place anyways. And everybody knew it at the time. Right. I mean, I knew it in 2004, and I would bet that you, because you're an insider, you knew that back in the 90s. So I guess my question is what changed other than you found yourself, like, look, Donald Trump is a repugnant human being. And even if he's doing all the proposals that Mitt Romney would have done, the tax cuts, right? The self-deportation, which is what the whole, you know, separating of the children was. Maybe Romney wouldn't have done that exact same policy, but the idea was similar.
You're wrong about that.
Actually. Well, self-deportation is an existing term of art, which means make things so hostile here that immigrants go back. No, that actually, was a complete turnaround from...
Let me get into that. If you look at the debate that occurred in, Romney was arguing against forced deportation. And there... In that debate, people were arguing that what we need to do was round these people up. And Romney said, no, what we need to do is we need to make the circumstances in their home country better so that they don't want to come to America. And we want people to leave on their own, which is basically the Obama policy, though Obama deported a lot of people, so that they voluntarily will leave. And he came up with this sort of awkward, weird phrase, self-deportation. But
he didn't coin that. I mean, that was a term of art.
I'd never heard it before.
Okay.
It pre-existed. Sitting there in the debate, when I heard it sitting in the audience, I was like, well, where did that come from? I'd never heard that before. But that's actually an example. And, you know, when it came up in the Romney-Obama debate, Romney explained that. And Obama, to his credit, said, yeah, this is not – really a fair charge against you in the sense that you were not arguing for forced deportation. And that really was, there were elements in the Republican Party at the time that were saying, you know, we need to round up 12 million people, which is an absurdity, would never have happened. But look, you know, I go back to this, it's not just about policy, right? So you take George Bush after 9/11, right? Iraq war was a disaster. There's no need for us to argue with that. But the way that he responded to say that we should not attack Muslims.
Right.
That's really important. And you think, and so these things matter. And it's not just, well, he would have had the same policy and they would have had, you know, the same policy maybe that Donald Trump would have invaded Iraq. But the quality of human being matters. And You know, one of the things that...
But wait, but let me ask you this, because this is another thing that I struggle with, because I think there's some truth to what you're saying, but I don't know what's in Mitt Romney's heart one way or another about immigration, but I suspect that, you know, Ronald Reagan at one point was for open borders with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And like you mentioned at the beginning of this, he gave amnesty to, I think, 3 or 4 million immigrants. Mm-hmm. Mitt Romney was reacting to all of those people in the party, the Republican Party, that, and you know this, you worked for Bush 2004 or 2005. They tried to, maybe it was 2003. I can't remember exactly. They tried to push immigration reform and they got the Republican Party. They were so out of step with the Republican Party, he got slammed. That was the beginning of the end of his administration, as far as I can tell. So it was quite clear in the aughts where the power was, at least on this issue, within the Republican Party, right? It's not a function. It's only a function of the leader if they are pushing back against the worst inclinations of their people.
To be clear, it actually was more where the country was. Because this is why Barack Obama never pushed for broad, comprehensive immigration reform when he had the Senate and the House.
Oh, wait. No, wait a second. There was an attempt to do it, and Rubio just abandoned the whole thing and left it at the table.
Go back to the first 2 years of his administration, when he had the House and the Senate, they never prioritized immigration reform.
That's absolutely right. I mean, they had it. They had it really for 16 months, a little bit less than 16 months. The control, because Franken didn't get sat until the summer, and they wanted to do health care and to do both those things simultaneously. Now, you could argue health care, immigration should have come first. And certainly I'm not going to defend Barack Obama's policies on immigration. He thought that he had to placate Republicans and thought that he could.
Well, it's a more complicated issue than that, to be honest, because where the country was on immigration and where the country is today has changed, I think. It's like a lot of issues have changed. But it would be naive to say that the majority of Americans were for open borders.
No, of course. I agree with that.
But just that a majority of Americans, there is a resistance in both parties to this idea of comprehensive immigration reform. And it's one of these things, I think, from when I talk to people in Congress and the Senate about this, or about reform, what they would always say is, you know, if 90% of us, we could agree on this in a day, that it's the 10% on the extremes, on the left and the far right, that has stopped immigration reform. And it's a failure.
Most
immigration reform is pretty common sense.
My recollection of the multiple attempts to do immigration reform was that there weren't Republican votes. Democrats.
I'm not arguing that Republicans were pushing for this. I'm not. I agree.
But the obstacle. Okay. I mean, we can argue as to whether what the actual obstacle, some type of reform, was at that time. But I guess my point is that there were indications there of all these things, and I'm curious as to how you didn't see them. And when we talk about, I mean, let me ask you this too, in terms of like personal responsibility, because, you know, and like I say, Mitt Romney, I'm sure he's a nice guy. My whole thing is I try not to be friends or know anybody I can possibly know in politics. So I don't really assess them.
Can I just say something? It's a little bit condescending to say he's a nice guy.
Well, okay.
Because if ever we've had a lesson that character matters and the quality of the person matters, it's right now. So
fair enough.
That Mitt Romney stood up to Trump, that he called out Trump in April. It's more than just being nice. He's actually been courageous about this, that he would vote, be the only person in his party that would vote for impeachment. So I think that
what's the polling in Utah?
Trump is going to win Utah by 10 points.
I understand, but that's different than saying he's got that. You know, he's not the highest favorability in Utah. I'm saying that, yes, okay. I mean, the courageous seems like a strong, a couple of things that I remember about the 2012 election. Okay. I remember that secret tape from the donors thing. Right. And and everybody remembers the 47%, right? That was where he said there are 47% of people out there who are not paying any taxes. He was referring to federal income taxes. Of course, they're paying wage, you know, the payroll taxes, and they're paying sales taxes. And so, but he was talking, he didn't specify income, but he just said they're not paying taxes. And he got right into the maker-taker divide. And I mean, I don't know if that's an indication of personal responsibility. I mean, what did you see when you were working on that campaign?
I was in that room. I can tell you exactly what happened.
Well, okay. Well, so what was that about? I mean, well, where do you
Someone asked a question and said, you know, there's 47% of the country that's never going to vote for you. And why do you even campaign? Why do you spend time even trying to reach these people? So what Mitt did is what a lot of people do. He sort of repeated the question. He goes, yeah, there is 47%, and they're never gonna reach us. And then he went off on it. Listen, I think,
well, let me ask you this.
Let me just wait a second.
Yeah.
Are you really trying to suggest that Mitt Romney is not a man of character?
I like I say, I stipulated. If you want me to say, oh, I'm sure he's a man of character. I'm no, but
you stipulated he was nice. Melania Trump is nice, probably.
Is she? I don't know. I'm okay. But if you want to say that he's a man of character.
This is where I think we get into trouble, okay? Where I think we get into trouble is when we look at this so much through a partisan divide that when you see someone like Mitt Romney, who has stood up to Donald Trump, there's absolutely, when Mitt Romney went out there in April, was it, of 16, and stood up to Donald Trump, expecting others in the Republican Party to follow him, or maybe they wouldn't do it. There was absolutely no upside for him to do that. And he did. And when he went out and he voted for impeachment, and when he called out, when he marched in Black Lives Matter.
I mean, what was he doing? Well, I mean, I don't want to get into an argument about you know, whether he's a man of character or not. I'm just curious as to, like, you know, how elastic that is. Let's stipulate he's a man of character. Like I say, I don't know him. You know him. But I'm talking about, look, in that tape, the thing that got lost in that tape that always struck me, because you mentioned personal responsibility, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but he said that he would have won the presidency by now if his dad was born in Mexico.
And, his dad was born in Mexico.
Well, if his dad was born, let's play the clip, because I always found this really stunning. Because
his dad was born in Mexico.
Yeah. All right. Well, then let's hear. Yeah,
remember, there's that whole thing about whether or not he was going to be legal because his dad was born in Mexico.
If he was born of Mexican parents, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. He said if he was born of Mexican parents, implying that if his last name was, instead of Romney, was like Ramirez, mm-hmm. that he said, and had he been born of Mexican parents, talking about his dad, mm-hmm. I'd have a better shot at winning this.
Sure. That's a fact. Are you arguing about that?
Yeah.
Why?
Because had his last name been Ramirez, his yep. dad wouldn't have been governor of Michigan. His dad wouldn't have been president of AMC. Maybe. Like, well, like, seriously?
Yeah, seriously.
I'm sorry. You think that Romney's dad, also another man of great character,
right,
would have been governor of Michigan in the, what was it, in the 50s or the 60s? Had he been of Mexican descent?
It's an unprovable.
It is an unprovable.
I don't know. What is your point?
My point is, though, this is a guy who's sitting there saying the implication here is mm-hmm. that you get a leg up in this society. If my last name was removed, well, what is he supposed to?
That's total bullshit. What he's saying is, Hispanics are, if you just step back, Hispanics are an increasing percentage of the population, right? America's becoming. George Bush got over 40%. That one of the failures of the Republican Party is appealing to Hispanics. And that why is the Republican Party in California in third place now? Largely because of the aftermath of what happened in 1994 when Pete Wilson responded negatively. Right. As opposed, interestingly, to Texas, where George Bush was governor, and they took a completely different attitude toward it.
He had better policies towards not the only reason, Latinos. Yes.
It's also the difference in Tex-Mex culture.
Sure.
But so if Mitt Romney's last name, if he came from Hispanic parents, it's arguable, I think, in just a poli-sci sense, that his appeal to Hispanic voters could have been greater.
But here's my sense. No, it does make sense. But here's my issue with that. It completely erases where he was positioned in life because of A, what his father had achieved, but also because of, frankly, his father would not have achieved that had his name been Ramirez. He would not have been president of American Motors. He wouldn't have been any of those things because of the nature of our society. And so this is the canard that I think, like, you know, that I think is, I'm sort of fascinated about this notion of personal responsibility. That's the complete opposite of personal responsibility, isn't it? It's like, because personal responsibility also means taking stock of, like, what I have that isn't necessarily a function of anything other than pure luck.
Yeah. Listen, if you go back and you read what Mitt Romney has said about this, one of the criticisms he got was not talking about how wealthy he was, how he had made money. And he refused to do that. And a lot of people said, like, in debates and things, like, you shouldn't apologize for the fact that you're wealthy. I mean, you went out, you started this business with a couple of guys, you made a lot of money. He didn't inherit money. He inherited every advantage in life. He inherited every, which he said before, but he didn't inherit money.
Well, I remember a comment where he was talking about they were living in the basement in I think it was Somerville or Cambridge. And all they had to live on was like $40,000 or $50,000 worth of stocks.
No.
Well, I remember that. I mean, no, that was a quote. So, I mean, I know it was a quote.
But he wouldn't do that because his whole thing was, are you saying that people should vote for me because I was lucky enough to make a lot of money? And a lot of it is luck. That makes me a better person because I'm wealthy. I mean, that is completely against every sort of article of faith and values that he was taught. And he never would do it. It was really, I mean, we'd sit around and debate prep, and I can remember Tim Pawlenty, who was, he's a great guy. He was governor of Minnesota. He would just say, like, Mitt, this isn't complicated. Don't be defensive about it. Be proud of the fact you made a lot of money. And Mitt would push back in this way and say, so that makes me a better person. So you should vote for me.
Was that in the primary?
Well, and in the general too. Look, you should vote for me.
Newt Gingrich took a big chunk out of him.
I should make a lot of money because I made a lot of money. I'm a better person.
Right. Well, really? Newt Gingrich. Well, but isn't, I mean, that was actually, I mean, that was built into a lot of the Republican ideology at that time. I mean, and for years, right. That poverty is in some way a moral failure. I mean, let me put it this way. When Donald Trump came along,
I don't think that you would call that a Republican. I think that you would call that, I think you'd call it larger than that.
Oh,
I think,
I'll tell
I think,
you something.
I think you call it, you would have to call it American. To try to just call that Republican would
I can tell you,
and frankly, childish.
I mean, well, first off, I can tell you that just in terms of Mormonism and, you know, that the prosperity gospel is very big there. And knowing some Mormons well, I can tell you that he would be very unique within that church to feel that prosperity does not equal moral righteousness. But put that aside, I don't know.
Well,
I will tell you this, though.
Hold on a second. He ran for president in 2008. You never heard him say that. He ran for president in 2012. You never heard him say it. In millions and millions of conversations. So I think that what that says about him is revealing.
Okay. May be the case. The idea that, so let's just pivot a little bit to this notion of, like, that the idea of within Republican circles, within conservative circles, the idea that money is not a moral righteous indicator and that poverty is not, I mean, all of that personal responsibility stuff really dovetails a lot with it.
I will tell you
that on the day Donald Trump ran for office, I know exactly where I was. I walked into MSNBC and I told everybody he is going to win the primary because they have been building, the Republican Party has been stitching a suit for years and he fits it. And he's going to get on that stage And there's literally countless hours. I am more money than all of you. I am better than you. Period. End of story. And every single Republican is going to buy it because that's what they've been taught for years. In fact, George Bush, the CEO presidency. Now, part of that, I guess, is the idea that he has some type of, you know, technocratic skills, et cetera, despite the fact that he might not have had necessarily as much of a CEO background as, you know, but that's part of politics. I understand you create an image, but there is a notion there that if I have achieved this level of business success,
yeah,
then I have some measure of moral righteousness. You don't hear, you know, Democrats you know, leftists promote that as an, as
Sure you do. Sure.
Tell.
You think Kennedy would have been president if he had been poor? Do you think Roosevelt would have been president if he was poor?
Absolutely not. I think they used their money for this. Absolutely. But and I
you don't think that people looked at them as successful?
I'm talking about their policies, though. See, this is I'm talking about their policies. And, you know, when Paul Ryan says that kid wants the brown bag sent lunch, it's better for them.
Look, I'm not here. I like Paul Ryan. I think Paul Ryan's a very good person. I'm not here to defend Paul Ryan.
Well, I'm not asking to defend Paul Ryan. I'm using him as an example of a Republican ideology. You'd never heard Tip O'Neill talk like that. You never heard.
No, but I've heard. Listen, there are countless millionaire Democrat candidates out there for governor, who run for the Senate. John Watt Brown, who got elected in Kentucky, who ran on the fact that he was a millionaire, that he had been very successful in business. This is not a Republican.
In Kentucky, it's a red state. I mean, I'm sure.
But he was a Democrat. What I'm trying to say is it's simply wrong. And there's a larger indictment to be made here that I think you would agree with. It is wrong to say that the division in this as a value falls just between Democrat and Republicans, and that being a Democrat isolates you from this this view. It's something that is part of American society. And I think there's good things about it in some ways. I think the aspirational qualities of it are good. They're good parts of it. Where it's negative is when we don't recognize the large societal forces that make it difficult for people to succeed. And the fundamental problem, and I write about this in the Republican Party, and I write about this in the book, is, you know, there was the Ronald Reagan thing that we all thought was funny, but summed up a philosophy. You know, the most dangerous words in the English language are, "I'm here from the federal government to help." So how do you square that, which is sort of a way to talk about smaller government and how government screws up things, and we all thought it was funny and true. How do you square that? Hold on. How do you square that with, say, the moment we're in now, where the federal government is what has to save us from this pandemic? How do you square that with the large number of people in the country on the lower economic spectrum that see the federal government as one of their essential tools to rise in life? So what the point I make in this book, if you've actually read the book, is when Republicans fail to attract African Americans, there was a fault in the Republican Party by saying we just didn't know how to communicate with African Americans. And there was a whole cottage industry of African Americans.
How to talk to African Americans, yes.
Where it was a failure to acknowledge it was our policies that I think African Americans understood us completely well. And they didn't see what was being offered by the Republicans as helping them in their lives, to put it in a very simple way. And that is the failure of it. And it's something that we've never addressed as a party. And it's a continuing failure of the party.
I think you would argue that they did the opposite, right? I mean, because small government may have been, you know, to some people been like, you know, government's a waste, it's bureaucracy. But to a lot of people, what it meant was what Reagan meant when he went down to Neshoba County, the Neshoba County Fair, and for his general election announced that, you know, with a bunch of Confederate flags behind him, this is about state rights. We know what state rights means, right? I mean, that's right. I mean, like.
So are you asking me to defend Reagan?
No. I'm not asking you to defend Reagan. I guess I'm still trying to get at.
Can we talk about that for a second? Because it's an interesting point, okay? So I'm a seventh generation Mississippian. I grew up going to Shelby County Fair. And for years, I defended Reagan at that for going there. Because Mississippi was a swing state. Carter carried it. We forget that, you know. And it was important for him to carry. And politicians go to Neshoba County all the time.
Of course.
I mean, you know, the most, what passes for liberal Democrats in Mississippi at the time, I mean, everybody goes to Neshoba County Fair. So I defended it for years. But when I was writing this book, I went back and I reread the speech. And I think what he didn't say is very important. And I think that it was a failure. And I write about that. And I think it's part of how I see it differently now than I did then. And he should have. He should have acknowledged it. To be that close to where Shorna Cheney and Goodman were buried and not to talk about it was a failure. But
do you think it was just an omission, or do you think it was a conscious effort to stimulate think about this. This is what sort of like shocks me about it when I revisit that.
Mm-hmm.
It was 14 years, maybe from 19. What was it, 14 years difference?
63 is when it happened.
So 17 years.
I got 425 on SAT math. So
yeah, I'm not so good on math in these parts either. But nevertheless, like, we're 20 years past when it would be the equivalent time having passed, right? I mean, that would be like, that to me does not seem like he should have mentioned it. It seems to me like he purposefully was mentioning something else, that either by omission or by talking about states' rights. Now, maybe I'm jaded and I'm cynical about it, but
where
I'm just curious.
Down, though, you know, where it kind of breaks down is if you look at the Democratic, you know, when Jimmy Carter came to Mississippi, he didn't talk about Shorna Cheney. And it's interesting.
Did he talk about states' rights, though?
Well, actually, probably he did. Carter would do that kind of thing. But I think it's a failure.
Did you know about Lee Atwater's perspective on this?
Listen, I wrote a whole chapter on this. You know, I'm the guy that said race was the original sin of the Republican Party. So don't argue with me with this. Okay?
No. I know.
Let me just say this. I think as a society, we are in a very different place in our recognition of the civil rights era. And I think that say in Mississippi, you know, it was only until the last 4 years we had a civil rights museum. And it's extraordinary if you go there. You know, Ida B. Wells may be the most famous Mississippian. I mean, most accomplished Mississippian in Iowa. I grew up, I never studied her. You know, it's fascinating, you know. And the way that the larger issue to me is the whole way in which the Civil War was cast, the whole lost cause, and that culture. I mean, I very much grew up in that. And I grew up in a family that was, you know, there's a phrase in Mississippi that was used a lot, you know, good on race or bad on race. So I grew up in a family that was very moderate on race. And in fact, I'm writing a novel now about white civil rights workers, because when I was a kid, my mother had this way of collecting people, and our basement was always filled with these white civil rights workers who were coming down from the north, and they were kind of these mythic figures to me, you know. But we still were part of that lost cause. I mean, I wrote a book after the Romney campaign. My dad had just turned 95, and part of the way we had sort of bonded when I was a kid was going to college football games, particularly Ole Miss football games. And I wrote a book called The Last Season in 2013. He and I, my mom, which kind of gave it a driving Miss Daisy quality, went to all the Ole Miss football games. And I used that as a framework to write about race a lot and to write about how the South is changing. To the sort of sadness of this moment. So finally, the Mississippi legislature 6 weeks ago or so voted to take down the Mississippi state flag, which was basically the Confederate battle flag.
Right.
And then that same week, Donald Trump gets in a fight with NASCAR over taking down the flag. I mean, it's extraordinary. So you've met Republicans are on the wrong side of a culture war with NASCAR. I mean, it's just, I think Donald Trump's whole view of where society is now is wrong. I mean, these take your average teenager living in the Mississippi, you know, white teenager. He'd a lot rather be a black rap star than Robert E. Lee. I mean, that whole world is just past. And I think his whole view of suburbs, you're talking about suburban women. I don't think people in the suburbs, they don't want their kids to think that if someone who is of a different religion or race moves next door, that they're not going to be reach out to them in kindness. I think he's
knock on wood. But he does know where the Republican Party is, right? I mean, that's why, I mean, let me ask you this then.
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't know where the Republican Party is, why is it that Lindsey Graham, Susan Collins, mm-hmm. Joni Ernst, I could go Cory Gardner, Martha McSally. I mean, where is, and, you know, Romney has said a couple of things. Definitely he's stood up to him. We don't hear from him that much.
Go ahead.
But the only other Republican I can remember who really spoke up against Trump is now an independent. Is he even in Congress anymore? I mean, he's going to leave. Not Flake from Michigan, the congressman who's the libertarian.
He left the party.
Let me put it this way. If Donald Trump doesn't know the Republican Party, the voters, why is every politician afraid to buck him?
I wrote a book that said Donald Trump is the Republican Party. So we have no argument over this.
Right. Okay.
I think my premise is that Donald Trump didn't hijack the Republican Party, that the Republican Party became Donald Trump. So, and look, I'm the guy waking up every day in the Lincoln Project trying to beat these people. So
let's talk about the Lincoln Project.
I spent 30 plus years pointing out flaws in the Democratic Party. So I've got plenty of credentials there. But what I've said is that I will work in the Democratic Party because I think that really the Democratic Party represents what is going to be the future for America. Because there's really three parties in America now, I see. You know, there's Republican Party, which is increasingly irrelevant and says no. And there's really kind of two parties inside the Democratic Party, an AOC party or Bernie Sanders and, say, a Joe Biden. And the result of that fight, debate, whatever, is going to decide the future of our policy. I mean, in 20 years, are we still going to be the only country that doesn't have national health insurance in Western democracy? Of course not. What that's going to be isn't going to be decided in the Republican Party. I mean, they've had a chance and they've already said no. So that to me is what it is. So I see the Republican Party as becoming, I look at California as the future of the Republican Party. So look,
I just interviewed Jean Guerrero, who wrote a book about Stephen Miller and made that exact same point that she thinks. But what you just said before that mm-hmm. is actually the biggest concern I have with the Lincoln Project. And it's funny that the Lincoln Project came up so close into that notion of you working in the Democratic Party and of this divide that you see in the Democratic Party, because that's actually, for me, mm-hmm. the reason why I wanted to sit down with you, because from my perspective, that's the biggest issue I have with the Lincoln Project, is that I'm not clear what the Lincoln Project is really about. And I think to a certain extent, your perspective gives a little bit of a hint, which is, this is about defeating Donald Trump, A, priority number one, no doubt, because it has to happen both sequentially and in terms of, I think, you know, for a whole host of other reasons. But there's a B there that I think people, Democrats, people on the left should be very aware of, which is, if they're like you, maybe they aren't. I don't know them. They see the future in the Democratic Party, and it's time for us to weigh in and stop and define where the Democratic Party goes. And so I see stuff on the
Lincoln. First of all, you know, I can't speak for the Lincoln Project. And
well, you work with it, but what do you?
I'm working with them, but I think each individual involved in the Lincoln Project, if you sat down, would have variations of different answers to this question. You know, because really, it's a
what's
little
your
bit,
answer to it?
It's a little bit like asking somebody about their, are you worried about your cholesterol count in a knife fight? It's like, well, yeah, I am, but I'm like more important than in a knife fight. So I think these are great questions for November 4th, November 5th, November 6th. It look, we're people that work in the Republican Party, right? And we have certain skills. So we had sort of three choices in this. We could either support Donald Trump, well, like that's not going to happen. Or we could have set it out. Or we could work to defeat Donald Trump. So that's what we're doing. And we don't confuse ourselves with trying to save the nation or, you know, we don't see ourselves as personally heroic. We're just like men and women. They just kind of know how to do some stuff. And
you guys are like those, what are those, not the Japanese, you're a mercenary on some level. It's a mercenary thing.
No,
right? I mean, you have a skill set.
It's not a mercenary thing because we'd be making a fortune working for Donald Trump.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, if at this point, I mean,
you know, Donald Trump, he's the most transactional person on the planet. Right?
I know.
If I went on television, I've often even thought of doing this as an experiment, but if I went on television for 3 weeks and wrote pieces saying, look, I was wrong about Donald Trump. I finally get it. At the end of that 3 weeks, I could be running the Donald Trump campaign.
Okay, well, then let me put it this way. You in particular, I think, of the people in the Lincoln Project, there may be others who are similarly situated. You have a skill set, right? You're a samurai. And you have a skill set, and it's not necessarily, you do have some measure of a code. It's not just about money. But there are other people in there who are political strategists. And it's funny because I critiqued a Lincoln Project ad or a tweet at one point, and somebody tweeted back to me, they're trying to get Donald Trump, the defeated. And I just don't think they're that calculating that they're also trying to position themselves in the coalition that defeats him so that they have a seat at the table. I'm expanding on what, but that was my point. And for me, when I look at a cadre of political strategists and I think, are they calculating? I think, they're the most calculating human beings on the planet. They're literally paid to. They're successful because they are trying to look two or three steps down the road that we're setting up legislation in September of 2017 to pass in December of 2019. I mean, that's what political strategists do. They push here and they expect an impact, you know, down the road. And so for me to assume that nobody in the Lincoln Project is thinking, we're going to raise money, we're going to appeal to the left and to Democrats, because look, I appreciate the work you're doing. I'm not convinced there's a constituency there for it. The ads are good. That's all well and good, but none of it's on policy. And I'm quite convinced that, like, I mean, this referendum might work against Donald Trump, might not. But there's a lot of reasons.
That's not true, by the way, that the ads aren't on policy. Look, what is by far the number one issue in the country? The economy. There are more Americans out of work this August than any August in the history of the country. More Americans have died of a disease in the last 5 months than have ever died for in the history of the country. That's policy. That's 100% policy. If we had the same rate of death as Germany, 140,000 Americans would still be alive. They have 111 per million. We have 544. That is policy.
Oh, no, I
agree. You have a confluence of uniquely deadly circumstances here. This increase of anti-science attitude in the Republican Party that merges with this anti-elite in part of the Republican Party, which is completely phony, which merges with this anti-big government. And it's a sort of toxic, perfect storm that has killed tens and thousands of Americans, which has ruined our economy, which is destroying the fabric of American life. When your kid can't go to school, when you lose your job because you have to stay home to take care of your kid because there's not daycare because no one will do that. That's policy. That's incompetent government. Now, part of that is character. Donald Trump is a gangster, and he runs the government like a gangster operation. You know, the person in charge of COVID is the person who's sleeping with his daughter. That's how gangsters operate, and who tried to set up his own friends. So these are the big policy issues of our time, right?
I would agree.
Yeah, and so look, I think it's a fair question to ask. So are the political consultants in the Biden campaign plotting to take over the Democratic Party? It's kind of, listen, let me tell you something.
In the Biden campaign?
Yeah. I mean, are they going to try to kill the AOC wing? I don't think so.
There is no doubt in my mind that the political, at least a percentage of the political operatives in the Biden campaign are definitely trying to fend off the AOC wing of the party. Of course.
And do you think that that's why they're for Biden? That they're not trying to just beat Trump? That they're trying to do something good for the country?
Oh, the people on the Biden campaign? Well, I think many of those people are hoping to have influence in a Biden administration. I don't think their only goal is to defeat the AOC wing of the party. But of course, I know people who work on campaigns. They're contemplating working in administrations.
Well, listen, I did this for 30 years. I elected more Republicans than anybody else out there. Presidents here abroad. I never worked in administration. I never wanted to. I never thought that I'd be good.
Well, no, I mean, I think, listen, I'm talking about the Lincoln Project. And like you say, you can't talk for other people, but you know, Bill Kristol, others, they want to have influence. They can have influence by writing in a magazine. They can have influence because they've built a constituency.
What's your point?
Oh, my point is that I think people on the left should be very skeptical of the Lincoln Project. I'm okay with what you guys are doing, obviously, defeat Donald Trump.
We live in a binary world, okay? We're either going to be for Trump or against Trump. You agree we should be against Trump?
Totally.
Okay, second question. Do you think we should try to use our skills that we have to defeat Trump?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so we're agreed on that. Okay, that's all that matters right now, because that's all we're doing. There's not some giant conspiracy out there, you know.
I don't think it has to be a giant conspiracy.
They're not even a little conspiracy.
Well,
there's not even that.
Let me ask you this. Can you tell me why Bill Kristol's doing this?
I think Bill Kristol is doing this because I think that he's a guy.
But you don't know.
No, hold on a second. You ask my opinion.
Okay.
You're right. I don't know, but I can give you my opinion.
Okay.
I think he's a guy who's 60-something. Who spent his life working for something that he believed in, that he thought was going to come to a greater good, who looks at it and is appalled at sort of what we have wrought. And I think that he sees that the conservative movement failed. I think he sees on multiple levels. I think he sees that what he thought was going to happen didn't happen, and it sickens him. And I think that he's somebody, because unlike me, that's actually his world. I don't live in Washington. I haven't lived in Washington in a million years. I mean, most of my friends don't even know who the president is. I have like these extreme sports friends, you know, so it hadn't affected me socially. I don't get invited to those parties anyway. If I did, I wouldn't go. So, but the guy like Kristol does. So it's really had an impact on his life. You know, he's lost a lot of friends. He lost his magazine. Weekly Standard was shut down because they wouldn't support Trump. He paid a serious price in that sense. I think he's appalled. I think he's saddened. And I think he wants the country to be rid of Trump. And I think that he and I probably have a difference when it comes to the Susan Collins of the world and Cory Gardner's. And I can debate that round or flat, but I know where I am. But I think that's it. I don't think it's really that complicated. I think
Steve Schmidt.
Oh, I know where Steve. I talked to Steve, you know, talking to him 10 minutes ago. Steve says thinks this is a national crisis. He thinks that this is the greatest threat to the country since the Civil War. And I actually agree with Steve on this. I think the next 60 days are the
most. I was worried about Howard Schultz, I got to tell you, though.
The most dangerous.
That was a cash situation.
The most dangerous period, I think, that we've had since the Civil War are in the next 60 days.
I agree. I agree totally. I guess I just look at things like, having been on going on MSNBC for 15 years and watching their entire, you know, a lot of former Republicans who are talking about Trump is bad. And then on the day that we bomb Syria, it is right back into the same sort of Republican posture. The we've got to do this. We'll figure it out. The generals will take care of it for this guy. He's a lunatic, but we should also let him bomb countries in this instance.
It's a separate discussion.
Well, to you.
It is a separate discussion. Look,
who does the Lincoln Project, what votes are they moving, do you think?
Oh, our goal is to take 4% of Republicans away from Trump.
What's your sense of how that's going?
It's going well. Yeah.
How many, I mean, can you see in polling?
Here's a perfect example.
Because I don't see it in polling.
Yeah, you see it in polling. Look how much smaller the Republican Party is. Trump.
Oh, but that's not a function of I mean, that. I mean,
sure it is. It's a function of something that's happening. Now, why it's happening, you never, causality in politics.
Right. I understand.
Established. But when you see Trump having these numbers of, you know, 90 plus percent support, and he says 95, he lies about everything, but say it's 88%. It's a much a significantly smaller group of people who are identifying themselves as Republicans now. And this is really important. So let me give you a perfect example. Wisconsin. Romney loses Wisconsin by 7. Trump wins Wisconsin by 1. But here's the dirty little secret. Mitt Romney got more votes.
More votes, right.
So, you know, I wrote a piece about this yesterday in the Washington Post, which is why I think what's happening in Wisconsin is very good for Democrats now. Why did Donald Trump win with 46.1 when Romney lost with 47.2? Really for two reasons. Third party vote increased. It doubled over 2012. Well, that's not going to happen again. I think we can all agree.
Right.
And non-white turnout, specifically African-American turnout, declined for the first time in 20 years. So this is a very simple race here. And Republicans understand this. This is why voter suppression is going to be a huge issue in this race, is a huge issue in this race. The country is increasingly becoming less white. Their share of non-white vote is either stagnant or declining. So it's simple math. For them to win, they have to reduce the percentage of non-white vote as part of the total electorate. And it's simple math. So I think that we're serving there's a lot of things we're doing. I mean, this morning, Donald Trump attacked us because we put out a spot talking about how his ratings were better than were worse than Biden's. So what does that mean? Okay, the one thing that every campaign has exact same amount of is time. So today, hours of the Donald Trump campaign are being spent attacking the Lincoln Project. I mean, we wouldn't vote for ourselves. Are you crazy? We're like political consultants. We like laughed at this. It's like, dude, it's insane. And that's a day he's not attacking Joe Biden.
Right.
And that's a good day. And you know, they go out and they drop this oppo on us and stuff. We just laugh. We don't care. So we know how to get in their heads. We know these people. All these sort of crooks and castoffs around Trump. This isn't. They're working in their first presidential campaigns, not because all of a sudden they woke up and wanted to work in presidential campaigns. They've been trying to get in presidential campaigns for years. I've done 5 of them. Nobody would hire these people. And like Jason Miller used to be my intern. I wouldn't hire Jason in a million years. So we know how to distract them. And that's a very useful, in war, that's a useful thing. When to create confusion. I think we had a large role in them firing Brad Parcells. We attacked Brad Parcells, pointed out he was a crook, probably, and stealing money, probably. And they got rid of him. That lost them 2 weeks. So now who do they have? They have this guy, Bill Stepien, who, you know, I did Chris Christie's races. He was a campaign manager. Good luck. And I doubt he'll be there come November. That's useful in a campaign. So now you look at the first to leave Donald Trump are the last to have joined him, which makes sense. If you watch 2016, at the very end, you decided to vote for Donald Trump. You had a lot of doubts about Donald Trump. So it makes sense that you would be the first to leave Donald Trump.
Right.
And those, the perfect example, those are college educated women who voted for him. And I think we've been very good at going after those women. The other thing that is really unexpected in this race is Donald Trump is starting to lose seniors.
Yes.
The reason Florida is tightening is because he's losing seniors. And why is he losing seniors?
Because he's killing. The party wants to kill him.
Yes. He's killing him.
Right.
So I think we're very good at this, being able to appeal to that. Nobody in the Lincoln Project wants to work in the Biden administration. We don't want to be ambassadors. We don't want to be, you know, anything. We just want to beat the guy, and we want to beat Trumpism.
And then what happens after you guys do that? Do you go back?
We're not, first of all, stop. We're not going to do that, because whatever happens, if Trump loses, you haven't defeated Trumpism. It's still going to continue in the party. And I'll give you a perfect example.
Yes.
There's sort of another Republican party out there, and that's these popular governors in blue states. Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, Larry Hogan. Phil Scott here in Vermont, where I'm sitting right now. I've worked for all those guys. I love those guys. If the Republican Party had any sense, they'd be studying these guys going, you're selling our product in the hardest market. Like, what can we learn from you? Instead, they kind of treat them with benign neglect. But here's what's really telling. None of those guys can pick their own state party chairman, which is unimaginable in politics. I mean, like, you're a governor, you're popular, you can't pick your own state party chairman. I mean, it would be like saying, like, you know, you couldn't decide what to have for lunch.
Let me just
shows how far Trumpism is in the party.
I just want to illustrate what you're saying for people who don't understand the dynamic. In other words, the Republican parties in these parties, generally the chief executive gets to put that person in the same way that, like, you, if you're president of the United States, you choose who the chairman of the Republican Party is. You put your person in there. They can't do it because the actual Republican Party, not the leadership.
Yeah.
Or middle management and down, at the very least, in those states, sometimes top management in Washington, are, that's what Republicans are.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm the guy that wrote the book that said that.
I know. You're the only one I would have on. I just want you to know that, which I don't know that you're terribly excited about at this point. But I do appreciate you coming on.
I think what's happened now, it's always difficult when you're in the middle of something to kind of realize the impact of it. But I don't think we've seen anything like it. I think we've seen a complete, total moral and philosophical collapse of a major party in America. And really the only thing I can liken it to is the collapse of communism in the Soviet Union, where what the party said it was for and what it actually delivered was so disparate that it just kind of collapsed. So I think there is a market for center-right party in America. But right now, I don't think anyone who's a conservative, Republican, with any credibility can tell you what conservatism is. They can't. What is it? I mean, we're to the left of Bernie Sanders on trade. I mean, Bernie honeymoons in Russia, but, he didn't, like, sleep with Putin. We're incoherent on the issues of character counts and personal responsibility. So, you know, say what you will about Elizabeth Warren. She has a theory of government. She can defend it. She can articulate it. You can argue with it. You can love it. You can hate it. But there's a theory there. And it's logical and it holds together. There's no such thing on the Republican side now. And eventually that will emerge. But I think I think we're in for a period of center-left government for a good while now.
And probably
eventually it'll go too far and something will come out of it. But I'll leave you with one statistic, okay? Just so you realize, like, how you're going to own the future, so you can maybe feel better about this. Americans 15 years and under, the majority are non-white. So the odds are really good they're going to be 18 and non-white. And that is a death sentence for the Republican Party as is now.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with certainly some of what you say. I sort of had that same opinion of the Republican Party, I don't know, over the past 20 years, but better late than never, I guess. But appreciate your time, Stuart Stevens. It was all a lie, how the Republican Party became Donald Trump. Really appreciate your patience and your hanging with us. Thank you so much.
Enjoy it.
All right, bye-bye.
Take care.
We will put a link to that book on our website. Interesting conversation. Guess we'll see down the road what some of these folks do. All right. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, and we give you bonus content every day. So, I just got a text. Sam, did you listen to Stuart Stevens on Chris Hayes' podcast? It's almost unsettling how the man was able to repeat whole portions of that interview with you today, virtually verbatim, even with you being a more challenging, hostile host. You know, I read some interviews with him, and that was consistent with what I read as well. The guy's pro. On message.
I appreciate his endurance. That was
his
fun.
Endurance, and he's out there. He's fighting the good fight.
Still, he persisted.
Still
with Sam, and that we were all better for it.
But
I don't think Rick Wilson would have lasted that long.
I don't think Rick Wilson would have, and I think Steve Schmidt would have walked off. Yeah. I mean, I just, you know, what he did not say in this interview, that in many interviews that I read him, he did say, he said, like, I'm not a government guy. I just ran the campaigns. And which I think is true on some level. I still think, like, this whole personal responsibility stuff. I'm sorry. I don't really know what that means. Yes, you should be a better person than Donald Trump. But I don't think that, like, anybody from the most conservative Democrat to the most left-wing critic of the Democrats would say, well, I don't know about that. Like, I just don't think that anybody has a principle that says you can be a jerk and an a-hole and a criminal, and, you know, it's not really, you don't really have to take any responsibility for that. I don't know.
I want to request a feature from the Lincoln Project, though. A lot of those guys must have interesting correspondence from their time working on all those GOP campaigns and stuff. It'd be interesting to go to an archive where you can sort by the Lincoln Project figure and all the correspondence. That's embarrassing to all those people
who are helping to perpetuate
this lie.
If you really want to put an end to that, you will do that. But there's a certain amount of hedging that's going on, and make no mistake about it. I think the most telling part, and if I was to say clip a part of that interview, maybe a couple of them, it would be when he starts talking about the Lincoln Project and then immediately pivots into, maybe I'm being a little too armchair psychologist here, but it's interesting that the first time the Lincoln Project comes up, almost the next sentence is the Republican Party is dead. There's going to be two parties. And one's going to be the Biden party, and one's going to be the AOC party. And I want to be part of the Biden party. I think that, like, and I don't know if he's talking about himself or he's just talking about an ilk of people, but that's my concern with the Lincoln Project. Now, obviously, they exist, and that's great. And sometimes they make good ads that are pointed towards suburban women. I don't know if David Cross is the best vehicle for that. A David Cross stand-up thing. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But
some suburban women appreciate Cross.
Well, I've made the point before that what they do in Hollywood, and that guy, incidentally, spent a lot of time in Hollywood, was a writer for Northern Exposure. He's written TV. I think he's probably written movies. He probably knows something about casting. When they want parents to go to a cartoon, I can tell you this. My son, when he watches Wreck-It Ralph, does not care that it's Sarah Silverman in that movie. In fact, I put him on the phone and said, you want to talk to whatever the character is with Sarah? And he's like, whatever. But dad, mom, they're like, oh, it's Sarah Silverman. I'll watch that. And that's part of the reason, like, what, you know, that voiceover, the main message is what he's saying, but they're trying to hit another subset of people with who's saying it. And I'm sorry. Maybe I'm just a conspiracy nut, but I think that it's very hard for me to believe that political strategists are not calculating, that they don't have a strategy beyond, you know, the first hill, as it were. I find that hard to believe.
They're not thinking about their cholesterol while they're in a knife fight, Sam.
I mean, like, even on this show, with the limited resources we have, I'm already starting to think, like, what if Biden wins? What if Trump wins? Like, I'm contemplating. I mean, I'm sorry. They do this. And to think that they don't is almost as condescending as I think you have to be when you play off a lot of these racial tropes onto your voters and just think that, like, they'll buy it. And they do. Just as condescending as saying he's a good guy.
Yeah, I do like his optimistic vision, though, of the chances for a workers' party in the United States.
One can hope. One can hope. But I don't know. But he is good. That guy is good. He's pro. Super pro. And what he also knows is that it was probably, as far as he was concerned, it was probably a race to see who could be more apologetic. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's competing. His competition right now are the other Never Trumpers. And so he needs to get out there and be like, I'm going to even go further than you guys. But I'm still going to hold on to these core principles. Like, this is the thing that I had to Lincoln Project. We need a new host body. The thing that just sort of, like, gets me is, like, his argument is not that the Republican Party walked away from him. It's that he didn't realize who the Republican Party was. But then he says, like, they got away from their core principles of bullshit, bullshit, and bullshit. From my perspective, not from his perspective. So I don't know what personal responsibility means. I honestly don't. If it doesn't mean the poors need to pull up their own bootstraps, I don't know what it means. If, you know, free trade, like, what, you know, I don't know what exactly what he's talking about. With free trade is the most nebulous term that there could possibly be. No willy nilly tariffs, I guess.
It's the right wing of neoliberalism.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean,
like, the normal wing, globalization, open borders for capital, all that stuff.
Right. Which fundamentally hasn't changed. He's getting into a couple of battles about tariffs. That's all.
Yeah. And by the way, the Republicans did not support immigration rights out of any kind of moral impetus.
No, of course not. But that's fine. I don't afford any moral impetus to, you know, the Democratic leadership any more than I do the Republican leadership per se. But I mean, Romney got up there and was talking about self-deportation. That's a long way from, you know, 25 years earlier, where Ronald Reagan is giving amnesty to immigrants. Mm-hmm. And self-deportation, people can look it up. That's a real thing that pre-existed Mitt Romney saying that. He didn't just make that up. He didn't make up the term self-deportation. Now, maybe Stuart Stevens was not privy to policy discussions that Romney had, but I don't know. All right. Again, join the majoritycourt.com. Also, AM Quickie, sign up for that bad boy. You can get that for free. We got merch. We're about 14 days and counting, maybe, I think, until the launch of the Carpenter Pen pencil set. You're going to get blown away by this, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody in the audience is going to be using Carpenter pencils. Jamie. Oh, and don't forget, check out Nomi's show. They're posting new stuff all the time. YouTube.com/The Nomiki Show. And Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
This week on the Antifada, Sean and I, we broke down some of the tragic news out of Los Angeles, Kenosha, and Portland, and then used it as kind of a jumping off point for a discussion of political violence, what that means, and how the left should take a, like, what is the least LARPy line we could possibly take on this in this day and age. I think it's a good thing that we take violence more seriously than the right does. So we talked a little bit about that and theories of revolutionary organization and spontaneity. Then in the second half, I teased this a while back, but it's out now. I spoke with three worker organizers from No Evil Foods. Well, they don't work there anymore, but they were working for this vegan food company with radical branding. But turned out when the workers tried to form a union, they used the same old capitalist union busting practices as any company that does not name their fake meat after the Zapatistas. So that's out now. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
What does that mean? LARP, LARP, LARP.
Oh, it's it stands for live action role playing. Which is like a really nerdy game that, you know, dudes in high school play, like Dungeons and Dragons, but you're like right. Using a stick and pretending it's a sword. This is often applied to leftists who have these kind of revolutionary fantasies where they're going to like form a red army in secret and rise up and have some sort of glorious revolution. I get called a LARPer sometimes. So I felt like it was important to address these because I think it's important for the left, for the anti-capitalist left to take revolution seriously at the same time that we don't descend into this kind of fantastical LARPing.
Live action role play.
I actually saw my first LARPers in the wild driving back from Massachusetts a few weeks ago. They had a lot out there.
Like, were they doing? Were they
swords and stuff?
Yeah.
I will admit to playing some tabletop games in high school, but I never went full LARP.
One of my characters in Beat Cops was a LARPer, I guess. He would go to like Renaissance fairs and dress up as the Knights of the Round Table guy.
Yeah, it's like the video game era Renaissance fair.
It used to be, you could see there were guys in, and girls, I guess. I mean, men and women, I should say, in like Union Square. And I think I saw them in Central Park, you know, maybe this is 20 years ago, where they would be doing that with swords. Mm-hmm. Just like recreationally.
I feel like there's a, maybe you remember this, Jamie, Ren fairs have like a communist history or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that's a future Antifada episode.
Interesting. You'd think the people who fetishize feudalism would not be communists, but you know, it takes all kinds to make a world.
Matt, go ahead.
Last night on TMBS, we had Malaika Jabali on. She was in Kenosha. We talked about, you know, the coordination between the militias and the cops and how that led to murder on the streets of Kenosha and, you know, the whole right-wing reaction in the upper Midwest and how that's not exactly maybe the worst place for black people in America in terms of certain economic indicators. And also a No Olympics activist, Albert Corrado, talks about he lost his sister, Melly Corrado, to a cop and they tried to cover it up. We talked about that also. So a pretty heavy police violence show last night. And David Griscom talked about capitalism's new play for oil in Kenya, which is to flood it with plastics. So check that out, patreon.com/TMBS.
See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
What?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Fuck you, reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Homo says what?
What?
Homo says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?